we go. Boy, oh boy, a lot going on in the news. We will get to Inslee, we'll get to the mask and all the other stuff that's going with it, Tom. But this is exciting because it seems like just yesterday we were doing Behind Enemy Lines. If you're new to the show, thanks a lot for joining the Tom and Curly Show. The way this will, of course, let's just take care of a little bit of business. You ready? Let's dive into the news. Dive in! All right, here's what happens. We started this about 7 or 8 years ago where we would call somebody in the other market. We used to do it with newspaper guys. We'd get them on and realize they suck. They don't have that same sort of, you know, that same style. They don't have the it, right? So then we were calling other radio guys and we would have them on. So we're going to be playing Oakland. We get the guy on from Oakland or whatever. And we wanted to see how they were preparing both mentally, physically, and emotionally for the loss that was about to come to them within That's about right. 72 hours. And then we got a little shaky last year because we'd call up. We didn't quite know how to, like, are we just come right at them? Like, we're going to beat them and, or, so a lot of times we would sort of throw ourselves at the mercy of another radio host, hoping that they weren't be too mean to our Seahawks, right, Tom?
Yeah, but and that was after we were 12-4 last year.
I know.
We actually had a good, but it didn't feel that way.
It didn't.
Felt like we were more like a 6-6.
Every Thursday we would do this. We're like, yeah. Oh, I don't know how you feel about this. So let's just, before we get this guy on, how are you feeling about Sunday? You okay?
I'm feeling okay.
Okay.
I think Indianapolis has a big question mark at the quarterback position, and that's the one thing that we don't have a question about.
Okay.
Our quarterback.
Okay. So I used to do sort of a John Facenda thing when introducing, so I thought I would steal something from ESPN's 30-30. If you don't know what it is, this is going to be lost on you. But you ready, Tom? Here we go.
I'm ready.
What if I told you? The lab tech saw not one, but three babies. What if I told you the first and last great block that he made was in his mom's nether regions? What if I told you that being a good eater and wearing clothes that looked similar to his sister's clothes didn't bother him? And his last great athletic accomplishment came at the age of 9. And that forming a wiffle ball league was not just something you did because you were too short to play real sports. And that sometimes miracles happen even in Turnbull. And then this is an uncomfortable
30 stories, 30 filmmakers, 30 years. ESPN's critically acclaimed 30 for 30, presented by Levi's, Tuesday at 8 p.m.
By the way, Derek Schultz joins us on the line now. And Derek Schultz is, by the way, the most famous triplet ever to come out of Turnbull, Connecticut. I spent an hour reading about you and your stupid sisters and your mom and everybody. Like, he's a triplet. And it's just like, this is like the biggest thing about you. Derek Schultz, you know that? The fact that your mom and your dad conceived you and you were the first one out, and this is, your whole life has made it into a 30-30 ESPN, just right there on the Tom and Curly Show.
Must
welcome.
Must be so proud.
So proud. How are you?
You know, John and Tom, when you aren't born special like I was, I can understand the jealousy and all the spite that comes with that.
Yeah.
So I've learned in my 38 years on this earth to just understand that it's okay. People want to be you, but they just can't quite get there. It can't be the miracle that you were.
Round of miracle. All 5 feet, 7 inches of you. All right. So let's, first of all, welcome and thanks for doing the show. You and what's the name of it? Because I came in. Is this a radio station? What are you on? Like low frequency or something at the radio? Where are you working now, Schultz?
Yeah. So. Me and another guy here in town had a show for 9 years on Fox Sports Radio with an iHeart station, and we got let go kind of in 2020 amid the COVID and everything like that.
Yeah.
So after our non-compete came out, we relaunched it on something called ISC Sports Network, which is a regional TV network here in Indiana. And I also do other stuff with the Indianapolis Star, so I'm trying to just basically hold on to whatever fading relevance I still have.
All right, good, good to know. By the way, all that stuff from you, the 30-30, that is all true. That's all about your life. Growing up, you were a twin and all the other stuff that goes with it. And now here you are really reaching the zenith of everything to be on the Tom and Curly Show. We wanted to talk to you about the Colts and the Seahawks, find out how you're feeling. And Tom is now going to pepper you with five-part questions. Tom, go.
Yeah. No, we'll just start off. As you well know, in Indianapolis, your quarterback is probably the most polarizing player, or at least most polarizing quarterback in the league. He was the worst-rated quarterback, 32 out of 32 teams, when he was with Philadelphia. How does Indianapolis feel about Carson Wentz as your starting quarterback?
Yeah, it's weird because you're right. Last year, Tom, he was terrible. Now, the Eagles were terrible. His line was terrible. His receivers were terrible. Everything about that team was awful. So I don't think it's all Carson Wentz's fault that it went that way. But you look back early in his career, I mean, this guy was formerly the number two pick in the draft. In 2017, he was looking to have this unbelievable second season where he was an MVP candidate. Yep. And the Eagles were in line to win the division, and then he gets injured. And then the Eagles go on and win the Super Bowl without him. And then he comes back as a starter in 2018 and 2019 and performed well. Like, I wouldn't say that he was a great quarterback in those seasons, but certainly was probably in the upper half of quarterbacks in the league. So I think the Colts, with Frank Reich, who, of course, was Wentz's offensive coordinator in Philly, are optimistic that they can get him back to that 2017-19 level. Because you're right. I mean, he completely fell off the cliff last year.
Yeah. And do you think that you are a good team that's just a quarterback away from serious contention?
The roster's good. I don't think that really is in dispute, honestly. The problem for the Colts is that the roster is good in areas that aren't important. Like, they have a really good guard named Quentin Nelson. And it's like, a guard, really? Like, who cares? Right? They have a really good punter. You know, like, it's some of these areas that are just kind of like, okay, you know, you need a quarterback. You need a pass rush. You need dynamic receivers. And the Colts, they don't know if they have those things because Wentz is a big question mark. They've got some young guys that they really like at defensive end, like Kamoko Touré. Ben Banigou, who they're kind of betting big on. Quiddy Pay was their first-round selection out of Michigan, who they're really high on. And at wide receiver with Michael Pittman, who's a second-year guy who had a nice rookie season at USC. They're hoping that he ascends to be kind of the number one wide receiver. But that's the weird thing about the Colts is that this is a good, deep roster. This is probably the deepest roster that they've had in almost a decade. You probably have to go back to the Peyton Manning teams. The problem is that at the positions that really matter, we just don't know what they're going to look like.
Yeah. And then on the flip side about Seattle, what do you make of the big Russell Wilson brouhaha in the offseason? Do you think that there's anything to that that could come back to haunt the Seahawks, or do you feel like that's just kind of like fluff, and once he hits the field, he'll be the same old Russ?
By the way, hold on, Derek. Let me explain. You know, Tom uses the word brouhaha. That's French. He's just gotten back from France, so don't let that throw you.
2 weeks. Just a man.
Okay, don't stop. He's from a place called Turnbull. He doesn't know where France is. Go ahead, Derek. Go ahead.
I think that, you know, my attention span is pretty short, so I only picked one quarterback drama to focus on this offseason, so I chose Aaron Rodgers. I didn't really pay a lot of attention to what was going on with Russell Wilson. It's one of those things, guys, to me, once the lights come on and the ball snapped and you're going. You know what I mean? Like, I think we obsess over these things, and Hawks fans lose sleep. They're, oh my God, like Russell Wilson mentally, where is he? Does he want to be here and all of that? I think once the game begins, everything's going to be fine. The guy's been a winner his whole life. I can't imagine that attitude is going to change for him. So I would, if I was a Seahawks fan, I wouldn't be the least bit concerned about Russell Wilson. I mean, if you guys want to trade quarterback situations, let me know.
No, thanks.
Derek, I've got a question from my son, Rye. By the way, second born, 10 and a half months apart. But I mean, they have a big deal, triplet thing. All right, so here's the... Rye said, find out from Schultz whether or not the religion that is shared between the quarterback now and the head coach will have any effect upon the two of them getting along and maybe even improving the Colts' win-loss record.
Yeah, look, there are a lot of connections beyond football between Frank Reich and Carson Wentz. Like, they're not going outside in the, you know, up to Lake Michigan and baptizing people on the weekends or in the off season or anything like that. But, you know, they make no bones about the fact that they're both men of faith, if you want to say that, and really, you know, hardcore Christians. That's who they are. That's what they base a lot of their identity on. So I do think the bond that those two had in Philadelphia had a lot to do with those shared beliefs and maybe philosophies and worldviews and all that. But as far as, you know, like X's and O's and on the field stuff, I think really football still at the end of the day is football. So from a rapport and a relationship and a bond standpoint, I think those things are important. Between the lines, I'm not as sure how relevant that's really going to play or how much of a role that's going to play for those two guys.
I see. And what kind of rules COVID-wise is your stadium using? Is that much of a controversy? I just spent a week in Indiana as well, and I realized that they're not as pro-mask as other regions of the country, let's just put it that way.
They're pro-freedom.
Oh, no. Indiana. Indiana, baby. Yeah. 55,000, no masks. For my cold, dead hands, we're going to put that vaccine. You know, it's whatever. I'm actually a Northeast transplant, so I've been here about 15 years, and there are some things that I really enjoy about Indiana. There are some things that are very different about Indiana. And, you know, Indianapolis itself, just like most urban centers, you know, our vaccine rate is you know, it's not Seattle, it's not the Northeast, but it's better than in the rural communities. But Indiana, once you get out of the donut counties here, you know, it's cornfields and it bleeds red. And that's kind of how the governor and the state legislator have handled these things, because that's really the governing bodies that control that now, since the, you know, federal stuff has kind of taken a little bit of a step back in the last few months.
I've got one more question for you. How important is it, just for the mental ability to face the rest of the season, for a team that has not won an opening game since 2013, did they really put a lot of pressure on their players to be able, this is it, this is the turnaround, if we win this first one, it'll really put us in the right mindset?
Oh, it's huge. They've won one opener since 09.
Oh,
so
right.
I mean, yeah, you have to go way, way back. Like, even Peyton Manning's last year, they went to Houston and they got absolutely curb stomped, destroyed. Yeah. And it's been kind of a running joke here that you just expect the Colts to start 0-2, and then you figure out a way to try to kind of go on this run to make the playoffs afterwards, because they've been so bad. But, you know, the good news is not the opponents, because Seattle is formidable, and I think the Rams are going to be a good team too. But you at least get the first 2 weeks at home. So I think they're hopeful that they can, I mean, you know, worst case scenario, hopefully split those two. But even in a best case scenario, going 2-0 would be a great way to jumpstart the season, because the schedule's front loaded. They got to go at Nashville against the defending AFC South champion Titans. They've got Baltimore on Monday Night Football in the first week in October. If Baltimore has any players that have any functioning knees left by the time that happens, it's going to be the first six games are going to tell us an awful lot about how this Colts season is going to go. Because as excited as people are, people still think that Carson Wentz maybe can reach this level where he used to be when he was a young player. I think this also can go the other way, because, you know, you talk about the COVID protocols. Carson Wentz is not vaccinated. All-pro linebacker Darius Leonard is not vaccinated. All-pro guard Quentin Nelson is not vaccinated. Pro Bowl center Ryan Kelly is not vaccinated. You know, the Colts have an issue when it comes to their best players are not vaccinated.
Yeah.
And look, I'm not here to legislate that and say, you know, argue it for, against, whatever. That's maybe a topic for a different show. But given the NFL's stringent COVID protocols for unvaccinated players, there's a lot of concern that those guys are going to miss games this year because they did not get the shot.
Wow. Wow is right. All right, let's do this. By the way, should we not let him take DK Metcalf, Tom? Can he take anybody he wants?
I think we can let him take anybody. He can even have Russell if he wants.
And by the way, did you notice that Schultz probably let it out of the bag that he already thinks the Seahawks are going to win? But here we go. Hit the music for him. All right. Derek Schultz from Turnbull, Connecticut. You ready? Here's what's happening. You are going to be there when the Seahawks get off the bus. You've got a frying pan in your hand, but you are disguised as a hot dog vendor, and you're using sort of a New York accent.
Hot dogs here. Hot dogs. Get your hot dogs. Hot dogs.
So nobody's suspecting you, Derek Schultz. And that frying pan in your right hand, you're about to hit one of the Seahawks over the head. As they're getting out of the bus, you can slide. One Seahawk gets hit on the head. You then jump on a horse because
It's the Colts. This happens to work out only once a year. And off you go with a semi-unconscious Seahawk on the back of that horse. You've taken that one Seahawk, and then you take his jersey, and you rip it asunder. Asunder, that's apart. And you then place him in an Indiana Colts uniform. Who do you take, Derek Schultz, to play for you in order to change the outcome of the game?
You know, this fits perfectly because Trumbull, Connecticut, which you guys have mentioned several times, is located in the southwest corner of Connecticut, just up the road from New York City. So this actually fits really well into my New York area roots of smashing people on the knees with frying pans.
Yes.
Look, the problem is that if you hit, you'd have to hit DK Metcalf with like a Mack truck. You hurt yourself.
I don't have a Mack truck sound effect. Get to it. We're running out of time.
I'm taking out Russ. I'm taking out the quarterback, and I'm taking my chances with everything else. I mean, he makes so much of their offense go that's, I think, the really – I'm tempted to take Metcalf, but I would take Russ because of Wentz. But Metcalf, man, would be a big addition because the Colts have a lot of – they need a playmaker, and DK, absolutely. He's one of the best that there is.
All right. There he goes. And most people take DK or they take Russ. And later in the year, they weren't taking Russ as much, were they, Tom?
No, Russ started off like a house of fire, but he cooled off.
Right, he had a lot of frying pan bouncing his head. All right, finally, Derek Schultz, what will be the final outcome of the game? Score.
I'm going to take, I miss the days when Seattle would play in the Eastern time zone and lose every time. Those days are over now. So I'll take the Seahawks with a last-minute field goal. I think the spread is 3.
Yeah.
So I think it's actually going to be end up being a push. 24-21 Seattle.
All right.
Oh, my God. We've never had anybody choose. We've never had anybody choose the Seahawks. They always, all homers, they go for their own. Wow. Derek Schultz. No love for the city that fired you from your job there. All right. Hey, thanks a lot. Appreciate it. Thanks for being on. Tracy tells you to look at traffic for us. When you're plugged in, you're not surprised. That's what I got out of that one, Tom.
All right. Wow. Be prepared.
I am prepared. How about that? We did Behind Enemy Lines. The guy did not choose his own team.
Yeah, but you know,
I felt sorry for him.
Yeah, the thing is that he's a 15-year transplant is what he is. But then you're practically, you're not much longer than that, and you've completely absorbed all the Pacific Northwest in your bones, haven't you?
Well, only because of my son. When it comes to the Seahawks. All right, Rachel Bell's rolling in here. Look at this, the Marcos Duke Casino, proud to bring you Rachel Bell. Again, when it comes to entertainment, they're neck and neck. It's Rachel Bell and Muckleshoot Casino. Our Bell.
When you're at the fair and then you're like spraying the water into the clown's mouth and we're like neck and neck. Like I'm trying to make that little car chug down the line.
And
that's me and Muckleshoot Casino.
Yes, for the great big stuffed animal that you don't really want.
Yes, don't want it or need it, but want it so bad.
good for you. September 11th will be upon us on Saturday.
Yeah, so this is, of course, the big 20th anniversary, and the people who had, the most traumatic stories, of course, are the families who lost loved ones in the Twin Towers. But, of course, there are thousands more stories of people's lives who were affected by this, and I found a couple of people who were there, so it's kind of like a story of them remembering what happened, but it's also a love story. It was the morning of September 11th, 2001, and Emily Churkin was headed to her job near the World Trade Center.
I was cranky, I was running late, and then the subways were delayed. And I was so mad. My first emotion was just like irritation.
I got out of the subway, and I could immediately tell something was going on. There was cops everywhere. People were running.
That's Ben Gittenstein. He was headed to his office in Union Square.
We finally emerged over the bridge, and I just remember this collective gasp as people looked out of the window, saw all this smoke. It's the Trade Center. The Trade Center is burning.
It's 8:52 here in New York. I'm Brian Gumbel. We understand that there has been a plane crash, and you're looking at the World Trade Center. We understand that a plane has crashed into the World Trade Center. We don't know anything.
I got out of the subway. It was like a salmon spawning upstream, like everybody is going the opposite direction, not just walking, like running the other direction. And then I saw someone from my office and she said, the courthouse is closed. Go home.
So Emily got back on the subway and went back to Brooklyn.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God.
That looks like a second plane.
Now it's obvious. I think we have a terrorist act.
I watched the second tower collapse. Like, I watched it fall. Your mind does not know how to process that. To be honest, I thought it was fake.
And I will never forget the screaming of sirens, like police cars, ambulances, fire trucks. And I realized the towers probably were going to fall at that point. And I made a very intentional decision not to look. I just decided I didn't want that memory.
Emily and Ben were 22 years old. They were working at their first real jobs out of college, and they were falling in love.
I was frantic trying to figure out where she was. Like, I kept calling her number and she wouldn't answer.
It was all about trying to get in touch with Ben, and we did reconnect. He ended up walking across the Williamsburg Bridge.
There were thousands of us.
A mass exodus from Manhattan, everybody just getting out.
I mean, I was surrounded by office workers. We all had our shirts unbuttoned and we were all hot and tired from walking in shoes that weren't meant to be walked in. And it was very quiet. Everybody was scared and confused.
Emily and Ben were a new couple.
Our first date was sometime in like June of 2001. It was only a couple months.
It's funny to hear you say that we'd only been together for 3 months, because in my mind, when 9/11 happened, we'd been dating for years. When we first met, I immediately knew that I was going to be with this person for a very long time.
How did you know?
Sometimes you meet a person and you didn't realize that's what you'd been looking for, but you're like, oh, that's what they're supposed to be like.
The fear and the trauma of the terrorist attack instantly brought them closer together.
What we realized later was that
everybody we knew who was dating somebody on 9/11 either got married
or broke up
within a few weeks.
It was very clarifying. You either desperately wanted to be with that person and make sure they were okay, or you were like, you know, I don't think they're that important to me.
It's really weird to me, looking back, how much of the foundation of our relationship was because of and related to 9/11. It was the vulnerability was what made us close.
Emily kept a detailed diary during this time.
You want me to read this?
Yeah,
oh my gosh.
Yeah.
He said it. I said, what? And he whispered, you heard me. I buried my face in his chest, unsure whether to laugh or cry. I clung to him and whispered back, I love you too.
It is kind of romantic to be in a disaster movie. I think it was about 2 weeks after the event, and there was a gas line leak in our neighborhood. Manhole covers started exploding upwards underneath cars and setting off the car alarms and lighting the cars on fire.
It sounded like a bomb. And in that moment, it was just like, oh, it probably is. We were so raw, on edge.
Freaked out. You just hold each other really close, and it's like really intense. That kind of fear, it's romantic.
20 years later, Emily and Ben are married, living in Seattle, raising two children. Emily said she was recently triggered by the trauma of 9/11. After the towers fell, smoke lingered in Brooklyn for months.
After a couple weeks, we would sort of open our door and be like, wow, I smell the Trade Center today. And so I think for me, the connection to the wildfire smoke that we're getting here in Seattle, a reminder of something traumatic.
When COVID started, when we had to leave our offices pretty suddenly, when my kids had to leave their school suddenly and come home, and it's not so much that it triggered 9/11 feelings so much as it felt familiar to me. It was sort of like, okay, yeah, the things you take for granted can sometimes disappear.
How'd you find those two, Rachel?
Facebook. It's kind of a good modern way to just ask if anyone has a story, and then you kind of sift through, and there's a lot of not good stories. If you're lucky, yeah, you find one person. And so it's interesting because I had interviewed Emily, and I was only going to interview her. And then at the end, she said, you should interview my husband as well. So I interviewed them separately. And so, you know, I got to hear them kind of tell the same story from both sides.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Mm. Yeah. Excellent. Very, very powerful. And it is interesting to think. I love that notion that that kind of trauma, it brings you apart. I mean, it brings you together or tears you apart. And the fact that they knew all these couples that were either, you know, brought so much closer or immediately disbanded, that makes a lot of sense psychologically.
Yeah, and then a few years later, they left New York and they came to Seattle, and it took them years to go back. I mean, they love the city, but I think they waited at least a decade because they just kind of just had this feeling that it wasn't going to be the same, and they didn't really want to visit the site, but they eventually did, and they went back together. And, you know, I would never know what it's like to visit it if I hadn't lived there. You know, it's different for me. I mean, I was an intern. It was my first news internship, and I showed up to the station and they told me to go home. I mean, I walked in and they said, this has happened. You're in the way. Get out of here. And a friend, I was telling him this the other day, and he's like, think of how good a journalist you would have been if they let you stay. You'd probably be working for CNN right now. Why did they send you home? But you know, my story, it wasn't impactful. I was 21 and I was not in New York City. So yeah, it's interesting. John, you weren't there still, were you, in New York?
No. Cairo is doing something. MyNorthwest.com, I think, talked to a whole bunch of us about where we were on the day and our thoughts and how we feel about it now. And I think Michael's putting all that together. Have you, Jacob, you have more on that when that thing's going to be out there?
I don't know, but yeah, we'll find out. Hopefully we'll have some clarity tomorrow.
Okay. And why did they ask Rachel Bell?
Maybe. I might have missed that email.
Okay. Well, maybe they might have told you.
Right,
I think
now
they told you to go home on that one. All right. There she goes. Thank you, Arbel.
Nice.
Appreciate
job.
It. Wow, great story, by the way. Available at MyNorthwest.com. Tracy tells you, I'll look at traffic for us. All right, here we go. By the way, the know-it-all quiz happening. Pay close attention to the next story that we're about to do, because it will help you tremendously when it comes to the know-it-all quiz. And fabulous prizes waiting for you. This is like a double prize day, right? One is, of course, the Seahawks tickets, 4 tickets, first home opener coming up next week. You've got that. You had to get the... Are we allowed to give the code Q word again, or the secret word, or no? Only once? Once?
Anyone? I don't know. That's a good question.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for asking. then, of course, the know-it-all quiz coming up at just 5:30. And this particular story will help you tremendously. Should we play? I've got the sound of it, Tom. But apparently there are these ducks. They're Australian muck ducks. And somebody... Musk ducks. And they found that there were recordings of these ducks made a while ago. And ducks, who knew it, they could actually imitate things.
There's a new study that just came out yesterday in the Royal Society Scientific Journal that said we all know that birds, songbirds and parrots, can imitate human voices. But no one thought ducks could. And in a 2-year research project, they ran across a 35-year-old recording of a duck named musk duck named Ripper. Uh-huh. And this audio file sent the musk duck scientific community all a Twitter, because they didn't realize that they could make sounds. And son of a gun, if they found out that there are other instances of musk ducks making similar sounds, it's got everyone upset and thrilled.
Mm-hmm. This is the duck that Tom was just speaking of saying,
"You bloody fool."
It sounds like Betty. You bloody fool. You bloody, bloody fool. I love you. Bloody, bloody fool, I love you. Where's the sound of the duck doing an imitation of the door opening and closing? Do you know how that one, Jacob?
I couldn't.
Is that just
that
too
one.
Much for everybody listening to the radio right now?
Can't you just open a door and record a damn thing? Come on, Jacob.
the door opening and closing does sound a lot like this. Hold on. No, you guys are laughing. Did you listen to it? I listened to it. The duck sounds like it's imitating a door opening and closing. It's part of it. This falls into the category of Jacob's stupid animal stories. Why? And then how is this supposed to help us that ducks can imitate human voice, Tom? Where do we go from there?
It's just information, but what they speculate is, why is it that these ducks, these musk ducks, could do this or would develop this? Because it doesn't seem evolutionarily very convenient or helpful for them. And they said that, here's the speculation, that they're very few musk ducks. Uh-huh. So when they bond, they have these really strong maternal connections. And the hunch is that this particular 4-year-old musk duck named Ripper was, sort of like hand reared by the caregiver, by the scientist or the doctor. And yeah. So it formed this strong human connection like it would with the caregiver, like it would with its own mother. Uh-huh. And one way to kind of indicate that closeness is to mimic their behavior. And so the speculation is that this caregiver, for whatever reason, said, "You bloody fool.
You bloody fool. You bloody fool."
I like when it goes up at the end.
You bloody fool.
Again.
You bloody fool. You bloody fool.
You bloody fool.
Ooh, it's like fool is a dumb. I'm not sure that's bloody fool. To tell you the truth.
Come on, Tom. That's pretty good for a duck, right?
It's not. It's what the duck is saying that I'm questioning.
I like
not
that
the duck isn't saying something, but it also, you know, when you read this, that was the first time I had a chance to hear it. When you hear, I figured it said, "You bloody fool!" You know, it's sort of like a exhortation.
Come on, Tom. It's a duck.
But in this case, it's more of a kind of, you know, like a sign of endearment. You know,
yes, you bloody fool.
You bloody fool, I love you so much. What's wrong with you?
I'm Tracy a musk Kelly. Duck. That's what's wrong with you.
Tracy
me.
Kelly, you're a bloody fool.
I am.
You're
yes,
a bloody fool.
All the time.
Yes. Okay.